Hello, and welcome to the second quarter of Western Civilization here at Mars Hill. During this quarter, we are going to be covering Greek civilization. And as we mentioned at the end of the last quarter, for example, with Egypt, Egypt wasn't very consequential, wasn't very influential in the history of Western civilization. It is an entirely different matter with Greece. Greece is going to be one of the most important, influential cultures for all of Western civilization. The Greeks will contribute in the area of politics, art, architecture, philosophy, the idea of history as we think of it, drama, sports, you name it. Greece is going to produce some of the most important and lasting influences and contributions into Western civilization. It will influence the Romans. It will influence the Middle Ages. It will influence the early years of Christianity and therefore Judaism. And so we might argue that this is maybe one of the most important cultures and histories apart from that of the Jews and the early Christians. And so what we're going to do in this lecture is give a broad and historical overview of the major periods of Greek civilization. So we're going to begin with what historians call the Bronze Age, which just means the period of time in terms of archaeology when they used bronze tools up until about the period of 700 BC. During this period of time, there were two large histories, large civilizations that we can call broadly Greek that took place in Greek territory. The first was on the island of Crete. The island of Crete borders the Aegean in the south. And so far as we can tell, this civilization on Crete was a palace civilization. It was a monarchy. It was quite peaceful. It was rather prosperous. They seemed to do a really good job of collecting taxes, and therefore that means they were pretty organized. And we don't know a lot beyond this because, among other things, we have never deciphered the language of Cretan civilization. Maybe the most important component of Cretan civilization is the palace at Knossos, and this, by the way, is where we get the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. Some of you are probably familiar with the Hunger Games stories. Well, the Hunger Games stories were inspired in part by the story of Minos and the Minotaur, that Greek youths were sent as tribute to Crete, and they were to be fed to the Minotaur, who was a half-man, half-bull creature. They were sent into the mazes. And it's interesting because when the palace at Knossos was excavated, it was labyrinthine, meaning it had so many halls and so many dead ends. One could see why one might think that there was a maze there. And you can also see the fascination with the bull. Bulls are everywhere in their artwork. They even seem to have a sport, which some people say is impossible, but a sport of bull vaulting. Bull vaulting is not like in Spain where they have bull fighting. Bull vaulting was where you let the bull run at you, and then you vault, use his head as a vault, and flip between the horns. We see depictions of this all over the palace at Knossos. So the civilization was a trading civilization. We find evidence of art and pottery and goods from all over the Mediterranean world, including Egypt. It was a peaceful civilization, a bureaucratic civilization, which just means they did a good job of organizing and collecting taxes. There are no fortifications, no walls, so that should tell us that, like Egypt, they, for whatever reason, for a long time, were not worried about invasion. They were pretty stable. And then, for some reason, after what appears to be a long period of prosperity, this Cretan civilization just collapsed. We don't know why. There's many theories. Some people suggest there was a great volcanic eruption in the Mediterranean somewhere that sent ash that made agriculture impossible and therefore made the island inhabitable for a while. There's many theories, but the bottom line is we don't know a lot. So Crete is sort of the earliest place we see civilization in Greece. Well, then you move to the mainland, and there were kingdoms in the mainland. We see rather less peaceful. These places had walls, and they had kingdoms that remind us more of what the kings that all went to wage war on Troy from mainland Greece might have been like. Strong, fortified fortresses. In fact, there's one that was in the middle of a lake. The lake acted as a kind of a moat. We find very rich tombs that give you an indication that these kings must have had, again, the ability to tax. Not quite as rich and peaceful as Crete, but in one tomb called the Tomb of Agamemnon, even though we don't really think it was Agamemnon, we attribute it to Agamemnon, there is a lintel, the top piece of stone over the two posts of the entryway that weighs something like 100 tons. In fact, these walls were called Cyclopean because it was thought that only a cyclops, only a giant of some sort, could have made them. And so this is what we call Mycenaean civilization. And it is this regional monarchy-based set of kingdoms throughout Greece that is during this Bronze Age. But then there comes a period of time we call the Greek Dark Age that begins about 1200 and lasts to about 800 BC, when there was a decline. And once again, we don't know why. When you cannot read the writing, or there is no writing, everything is speculation based on archaeology, and it just leaves you a whole lot less to say. But we can tell there's a population decline. We can tell that larger palaces declined. We can tell that administration, particularly things like taxing, declined. This is the period of time that the Trojan War probably happened. We now believe something like the Trojan War happened, although the causes and the speeches and whatnot are not historical. We do believe that the story of Homer retains some nuggets of historical accuracy. This period of time, as I said, there was no writing, and so it's an entirely oral culture. And you should remember that just because people don't read and write does not mean they're not smart or educated. In fact, being able to memorize and learn many things orally, is a sign of a different kind of intelligence. And so this is the era of Homer, or at least this is the era that Homer wrote about. Now, when you get to the story of the Iliad and the Odyssey, historians realize that there's many layers and that there are pieces of earlier times recorded there. For example, we're pretty sure that during these Dark Ages there was no single combat like you saw on occasion in the Iliad. Sometimes the armor and the weapons described we know were from a much earlier period of time. So we know Homer is recording stories that have gone on, passed on orally for a long, long period of time. So, at any rate, this Dark Age is a period of when there are warrior chieftains, people like Odysseus and Achilles, who ruled over small areas and battled a lot. And so we see these sort of farming communities ruled by local lords. And again, there's not a whole lot more that we know about them except the glimpses that we get in the literature and the stories of Homer. The next major period of time goes from about 700 to about 500 BC, and we call this Archaic Greece. And this is perhaps the more interesting and the more important. In fact, it is often called the Pivotal Age, because there are several things that happen during this time that develop into the hallmarks of Greek civilization. First of all, we see population increase. We find more and more villages and towns. We see large migrations from other places where people are moving into this area along the Aegean Sea. We see the division of labor, meaning there are various people that develop trades. Everybody's not just merely surviving, but people can have trades where they offer services and get money in exchange or food in exchange. So we see a little bit more complex society develop. We see wealthier classes emerge. People who have more resources, more money, can spend more time, more free time, not just surviving, not just fighting, not just farming. We also see what is going to be one of the most important features of ancient Greek civilization, and in fact, maybe the feature that is responsible for all of its contributions. That is the polis, P-O-L-I-S. The plural of that is poleis, P-O-L-E-I-S. The polis was something like a small city that acted as a small kingdom. They were independent countries, but in very small areas, maybe no larger than a county, in ancient Greece. They became these sort of places where there was a high degree of political experimentation. They have a great diversity in terms of how they were governed. Everything from monarchies to oligarchies to the earliest democracies. As I said, they're independent. For most of Greek history, there's not one large thing you could call Greece. There's many people who speak various dialects of Greek. And there's many, many of these poleis. Poleis seem to originate around some high defensible area with a fortress where people that lived in the area could go to for protection. These turn into villages and homes around them. And so a poleis is sort of this downtown center where there's trading, where there's worship, where there's defense, and the farming land that surrounds that area. So it acted as a market, as a town square, as a place of defense. And importantly, as I indicated, each polis developed independently and had its own self-governance, its own sovereignty, and each one was ruled differently. Their political experimentation was key. And later on, the philosopher Aristotle would do a polis by polis study of the various ways the various poleis all throughout ancient Greece did their government. And we still, our government is based in large part on the study of those various forms of government that those poleis used. You can see the word polis in some English words. For example, Indianapolis, that word at the end is that Greek word polis that kind of means city, but maybe something more like city-state. You can see the word polis in all of our words related to the word political. In fact, political means something like, in its origins, it means something like the discussion of life in a polis. In fact, Aristotle is also famous for a quote, man is a political animal. And what he meant by that is man is an animal designed and that thrives best in a polis. Now, I should mention this because later on, the Greeks are going to realize that what they had, these small independent city-states, was very unique, that most people lived in empires or kingdoms that were stretched over larger areas and that had rulers afar off. And the Greeks were very proud of their unique institutions. And as I indicated, Aristotle said this is the best way to live. So it is during this archaic period, 700 BC to 500 BC, that the polis develops, that population increases in Greece. You see the emergence of writing for the first time. The Greeks will borrow from the Phoenicians an alphabet. The Phoenicians are going to develop, this is maybe one of the most important inventions in the ancient world, the invention of a very simple system of writing, rather than thousands of characters like in cuneiform or very complicated syllabic and pictographic writing like in Egypt, you now have more or less a phonetic alphabet. And that is going to allow people to begin to write more than just records of trading goods. They're going to write literature and philosophy and many, many other things, poetry, songs. In archaic Greece, you see the development of a new kind of fighting. There was no official military, there was no knight class, there was no people whose full job was writing. Instead, in most city-states, the men, who were citizens of those city-states, were responsible for the fighting, not unlike the Minutemen in early colonial America. When there was war, the average citizen of a Greek polis would go and strap on his bronze armor and go out and fight in a very unique way. The Greeks would line up in rows, maybe eight deep, shoulder to shoulder. They had tall shields, almost as tall as a man. And you would stand very close, shoulder to shoulder, with a man on either side, and your shields would overlap, creating this bronze wall. And each man would have a spear. And basically, their method of fighting was these very aggressive pushing matches where you were pressing up against another line of men, another phalanx of fighters, and you tried to break through. The Greeks fought very aggressively. And this fighting style is actually going to later on be very effective against huge empires and much larger armies. And again, maybe the most important thing is it wasn't professionals who were fighting, but it was average citizens. So we also see this, and this creates a large degree of participation in these Greek polis. Another important feature of this is that you get the idea that is unique to Greece and is going to later be appropriated by other cultures of citizenship. Of people who have full rights of membership and responsibility in the government. And now in ancient Greece, I should point out that it was only adult males, not slaves, not women, not young people, not foreigners, who were given citizenship. But it is important, this idea of those who belong, those who have responsibility, those who have authority, those who have access, and those who don't. It is also during this time, as I said, there was a large degree of population growth, more and more polis developing. Sometimes these polis got too big. In fact, there was such a thing as too large of a polis. And the Greeks developed something that was really kind of brilliant that sort of prevented these polis from getting too large, too unwieldy, too impersonal. And that was the idea of colonization. They would gather together a large group of the citizens of that polis, and they would travel somewhere else, usually by sea, and set up a new colony. The Greeks did this all over the Mediterranean, but mainly and primarily in southern Italy. So the Greeks actually had a lot of colonies in southern Italy, and these colonies from the mother city would be trading partners and would have all kinds of correspondence back and forth. So this practice of colonization, of sending out little pods of the city-state, were very important. Okay. I should also mention that it is during this period of time that sort of the mythology of the Greeks develops. The Greeks have all these gods that you've come to be familiar with in the Iliad. I should mention, as many of you noted in your papers, that they had ambivalent relationships with their gods. In other words, they weren't so sure about their gods. In fact, sometimes they could be quite irreverent. And there was nothing like devotion to one god, despite the fact that Zeus was kind of a father god. The Greeks did not have the idea that you should worship one god exclusively or one more importantly than others. There were devotees, people devoted to various of the gods, and many people worshiped multiple ones. And so there were many, many cults, and people went to all of those. I should also point out that it seems as though many Greeks weren't so sure about those gods. In other words, you get the notion that some Greek thinkers and writers and philosophers in these early years aren't exactly convinced. They seem to think that the discussion of Hermes and Zeus and Aphrodite are useful and can be instructive in some ways, but they don't necessarily seem to think that it's all true or all exactly accurate for the way the universe is. And this is going to pave the way for questions about really what the nature of reality is, and that paves the way for philosophy. I should also mention that in this archaic age, you get the emergence of the Greek Olympic Games. These were something that took place every 4 years. If there were any wars between poleis going on, they were officially stopped, and this was an agreement among all the Greeks. And they would go and compete. There would be individuals from every city. There was no team sports in ancient Greece, and you can kind of understand why that is in a culture influenced by the Iliad, right? It was all about individuals and their glory, not about the team so much. And these these Olympic participants competed in many things: singing, speech giving, not just sports. Although there were sports, there was running, there was various sports that we still associate with the Olympics, like javelin throwing and discus and wrestling. It should also be noted that the Greeks participated in most of these sports naked, which you can understand why later Jews who saw Greeks doing this were quite offended at this. It made sports rather unusual. And the Olympics were also religious festivities. They were devoted to various of the gods of Olympus. So 776 was the first Olympic Games, and they were celebrated for many, many years after that. This is also the period of time when the oracle at Delphi emerged. Now, just briefly, there were many oracles in ancient Greece. These were shrines that often dedicated to a particular god, Apollo usually. And usually there was some sort of priesthood there that governed over a kind of a prophetic office. So for example, at Delphi, they used young girls who they would send into a cave, and it was thought that these girls became possessed or voices for the god. And people would come and inquire. They would pay money, and they would get advice from the oracle. Should I invade? Should I marry this woman? Should our country form an alliance, our polis form an alliance with this polis? And these oracles became enormously influential. The oracle at Delphi most significantly. In fact, I'll relate two episodes. The oracle at Delphi was consulted both in the case of Croesus, the king of Lydia, who asked the oracle if he should attack the Persians. And the oracle said, famously, if you attack the Persians, a great empire will fall. Well, Croesus took this as a sign that he would succeed. What he didn't realize is that what happened was that it was his empire that fell. And so the oracle, you know, the key to being an oracle is to give an ambiguous answer that could be fulfilled or interpreted as fulfilled, either way the outcome lay. The other famous incident with the Oracle of Delphi is that the later philosopher Socrates, a friend of his went and said, who is the wisest person in Greece? And the oracle said, Socrates. And Socrates was actually quite offended by this, didn't believe it. We'll fill that story in later, but the oracles were very wealthy and very important, and the oracle at Delphi was perhaps the most wealthy and the most important, most influential. And so you have this very diverse religious environment, again, with a limited level of actual devotion and maybe a bit of skepticism among many of the more educated people about the gods and their reality. In fact, it is in this time that Greek reason and rationality emerges. You have individuals questioning the nature of reality. Perhaps most famously, the question of what everything is made of. What is the world made of? They were really asking questions that we might call questions of physics, although they didn't do experiments so much, they did speculation. So famously, there's an early Greek philosopher during this period of time who said all is water. He said all is water because he looked at the world and saw change. People grow old and die. The buildings decay. Everything in life is change. And he said, well, what is it that is most changing? And he said, water. So his speculation was that everything was made of water. And that sounds kind of funny and quaint to us, but you need to see that that was the emergence of very systematic question asking about the world and the nature of the world. And it's going to pave the way for Greek philosophy, which is going to be hugely influential. These philosophers are not really that interested in myths, except as the myths illustrate points they want to make. And there is a preoccupation among most of these thinkers with change. Change is a bad thing. The world is always changing, and we want to lay hold of what is unchanging. And so this is going to be a very important foundation to the way Greeks thought and questioned and looked at the world and sought explanations for the way the world was. This is also the period of time, 700 to 500, when Greek art is developed, especially sculpture, very, in fact, realistic sculpture of the human form, usually nude, usually of various gods or various athletes or both. This is the period of time when maybe the most important polis of Athens emerged, that is the city-state or the polis of Athens and the polis of Sparta. There's other famous polis. Corinth was one. It was a commercial trading polis. Sparta was a sort of a military hardcore polis. And then Athens, which emerged as, I kind of like to say, the hippie polis, but it's not really fair. They were the creators of radical democracy, but also the creators of a lot of literature and arts, and in many ways, one of the more tumultuous of the polis. All right, the next period of Greek history goes from 500 to 323, and this is the classical period, or we might call this the Golden Age. This is the time when all of the most famous contributions of Greek civilization emerge, and most importantly, probably, or mainly, from the city of Athens. It is during this time that Athens and Sparta emerge as two of the most powerful of the polis. Athens will be a great naval power. They develop a huge navy. Sparta will be a great military power. They had the best, most advanced, toughest of armies in all of Greece. And it is during this time that some of the most famous and consequential wars of the Greeks took place. First, two wars with the Persian Empire. The Persians are going to look at this this little thin strip of Greek city-states along the Aegean coast, and they're going to want to conquer them. And one of the greatest upsets in history, up there with David versus Goliath, was these little Greek city-states banding together and defeating the Persian Empire, not once, but twice, decisively. It was one of the biggest upsets in world history. After the Persian Wars, the Greeks kind of fought their own internal civil war, centered around a group of city-states allied with Athens and a group of city-states allied with Sparta. We will go into greater detail later on about these city-states, but again, I just want to mention that Athens became the center of philosophy. Athens became the center of the writing of history. Athens became the center of drama as we know it. And it became the center of art, particularly architecture and sculpture. Well, the Classical Age, or the Golden Age of Greece, ended at a very specific date, you'll note. Remember, everything else has sort of been rounded. But this period of time ends, in particular, at 323. 323 is when Alexander the Great dies. Now, I need to back up a bit, because towards the end of the classical period, a sort of rough kingdom, it was Greek, but they didn't have a polis. The Greeks thought of them as somewhat uncouth and uncivilized. They're in the northwest corner of the Aegean. The kingdom of Macedon. They were a large mountainous culture. They had rode on horseback. As I said, they had kings, and they were considered sort of bumpkins. Well, Macedon emerges more and more powerful and are eventually able to conquer all of what we consider modern-day Greece, including Athens and Sparta. And the king of Macedon, Philip, had plans to invade what was basically modern-day Turkey, invade more or less Persia, and get revenge on the Persians for their two attempts at conquering Greece. Unfortunately, Philip died, maybe by the designs of his son, Alexander. Alexander will take up his father's ambition, create an army with a crack cavalry, invade Persia, and Alexander the Great, over a period of 7 years, from 330 to 323, will conquer the Persian Empire, Egypt, the two greatest empires of the ancient world, gobbling up small kingdoms all along the way, and conquer all the way to the Indus River in India. So Alexander the Great creates this huge empire. And in 323, his soldiers there at the Indus River say, "Hey, we've had enough. We want to go home." Alexander promptly goes home to his new capital, Persepolis, which was formerly the capital of the Persian Empire, and dies. We don't know how. He was either sick, or he drunk himself to death, or both. But he dies in 323. And this begins what is known as the Hellenistic period. The Hellenistic period was this time when, under the influence and inspiration of Alexander, Greek culture was exported all over the ancient world. It was exported not out of altruism or sort of, "Hey, everybody, we want to share this with you," but it was exported as a way to create unification. If everywhere you went, to every major city in this empire you went, you found a theater and a gymnasium for exercising and for men to gather, philosophical schools, amphitheaters, horse racing venues. If everywhere you went, you found the same kind of culture, Alexander thought that that would keep his empire together. And so Hellenism, or the Hellenistic period of time, is this exportation of Greek culture and mixing with all these cultures, and it creates this vast sort of empire, united by the Greek language and culture and the mix of all these local cultures. So that's our last period of time that we're going to discuss, which is the Hellenistic era from 323 to 146. It is a time of great urban life, large cities all over this the Aegean and what we think of as the Middle East. Maybe the most spectacular of these cities was the city of Alexandria, a large city with all the features of Greek life. We consider this period a time of the exportation of Greek literature, sort of the unification of literature and Greek religion with all the local religions. You see the widespread use of philosophy and all the philosophical writings of Athens spreading out everywhere. You see math and science spreading out everywhere. So Hellenism, despite the fact that Alexander's empire actually splits up after his death, the influence of the Greek language and Greek culture will last all the way up into the Roman period. In fact, Greek culture will be very, very important and influential and significant for the Roman period. Okay, one last thing we need to comment on is something perhaps I should have mentioned at the beginning, which is the geography of Greece. If you look at a map, if you Google a map of ancient Greece, you'll note that what we call ancient Greece was a thin strip of land on the Aegean Ocean, the square footage of which was minuscule. In fact, it's estimated that most of the places that the Greeks lived, most of the territories in which they lived, only 10% of the land was flat. 90% of their land you couldn't live on or grow things on. It was rocky, hilly, small mountains. And so the Greeks are these people that live hugging next to the sea. And this sort of dictates their diet, and it also explains why they never unified, because there's always mountains and bays and water separating the various poleis. There's also islands, all thousands and thousands of islands all over the Aegean Sea that are also a part of Greek culture. So you can understand why the primary diet of the Greeks was olives and olive oil, which you can grow in rocky conditions, wine, grapes, which you can also grow in rocky conditions, some grains. You have to have, that's always a staple, is some kind of grain. Goats and their dairy products, or the milk products and their meat, and also lots of fish. This is the, today, what we consider the Mediterranean diet, and that's the diet that they had, and their largest resource at the time. So, again, I'll close with pointing out the irony of the fact that here was these tiny little itty-bitty cities in a very small area spread out over the Aegean that wind up, though they don't have a lot of land geographically, wind up being one of the most influential and interesting cultures in all of world history, influential even up until today. So in the weeks to come, we will go into greater detail on these historical periods, and in particular, the city of Athens and all of its contributions. We'll see you next time.